with what he has. With the caveat that it is much more difficult and much more dangerous and much more interesting to be a magician than it is to be a carpenter. Delivering this edifying lecture was Professor March, whom Quentin had last seen during his examination. He was the round, red-haired man with the hungry lizard. Because he was plump and red-faced, he looked like he should be jolly and easy-going, but in actuality he was turning out to be kind of a hard-ass. When Quentin woke up that morning, the huge, empty house was full of people. Yelling, running, noisy people who dragged trunks thunderously upstairs and occasionally banged open his door, looked him over, and then slammed it shut again. It was a rude awakening. He'd gotten used to wandering around the house by himself as its undisputed lord and master, or at least, after Elliot, its senior undersecretary. But as it turned out, there were 99 other students enrolled at Breakbills, divided into 5 classes that corresponded roughly to freshman through first-year graduate student. They had arrived this morning en masse for the first day of the semester, and they were asserting their rights. They came in clumps, materializing 10 at a time on the back terrace, each group with a hillock of trunks and duffel bags and suitcases beside it. Everybody except Quentin was in uniform. Striped blazers and ties for the guys, white blouses and dark tartan skirts for the girls. For a college, it all looked a whole lot like a prep school. "It's jacket and tie at all times, except in your room," Fogg explained. "There are more rules. You'll pick them up from the others. Most boys like to choose their own ties. I am inclined to be lenient on that score, but don't test me. Anything too exciting will be confiscated, and you'll be forced to wear the school tie, which I know very little about these things, but I am told is cruelly unfashionable." When Quentin got back to his room, he found a closet full of identical jackets hanging there, dark blue and chocolate brown in inch-wide stripes, paired with white dress shirts. Most of them looked brand new. A few showed signs of incipient sheen at the elbows or fraying around the cuffs, and smelled faintly, but not unpleasantly, of mothballs and tobacco and former occupants. He changed gingerly and looked at himself in the mirror. He knew that he was probably supposed to resent the uniform, but he relished it. If he didn't feel like a magician yet, at least he could look like one. Each jacket had an embroidered coat of arms on it, a golden bee and a golden key on a black background dotted with tiny silver stars. He would later hear other students call this device the key and bee, and once he started looking for it, he saw it everywhere, worked into carpets and curtains, carved into stone lintels, pieced into the corners of parquet floors. Now Quentin sat in a large, square lecture hall, a corner room with high, lofty windows on 2 sides. It contained 4 rows of elegant wooden desks set on raked steps, like an amphitheater, looking down on a large blackboard and a massive stone demonstration table that had been scorched, scratched, scarred, and scathed within an inch of its life. Particles of chalk dust hung in the air. The class had 20 students, all in uniform, all looking like very ordinary teenagers trying very hard to look cooler and smarter than each other. Quentin knew that probably half the Intel Science Talent Search winners and Scripps Spelling Bee champions in the country were in this room. Based on what he had overheard, one of his classmates had placed second in the Putnam competition as a high school junior. He knew for a fact that one of the girls had managed to take over the plenary session of the National Model UN and push through a motion sanctioning the use of nuclear weapons to protect a critically endangered species of sea turtle. This while representing Lesotho. Not that any of that stuff mattered anymore, but the air was still thick with nerves. Sitting there in his new-smelling shirt and jacket, Quentin already wished he were back on the river with Elliot. Professor March paused, refocusing. Quentin Coldwater, would you please come up to the front of the class? Why don't you do some of your magic for us?
March was looking straight at him.
That's right.
His manner was warm and cheery, like he was giving Quentin a prize.
Right here.
He indicated a spot next to him.
Here, I'll give you a prop.
Professor March rummaged in his pockets and took out a clear glass marble, somewhat linty, and put it on the table where it rolled a few inches before it found a hollow to settle in. The classroom was absolutely still. Quentin knew this wasn't a real test. It was some kind of object lesson slash hazing ritual. An annual thing, probably nothing to worry about, just one more wonderful old Brakebills tradition. But his legs felt like wooden stilts as he made his way down the broad steps to the front of the class. The other students stared at him with the cold indifference of the gratefully spared. He took his place next to March. The marble looked ordinary, just glass with a few air bubbles in it, about the same circumference as a nickel. Probably about as easy to palm, too, Quentin supposed. With his brand-new school jacket on, he could cuff and sleeve it without too much trouble. All right, he thought. If it's magic they want, magic they shall get. Blood thundering in his ears, he produced it from either hand, from his mouth, from his nose. He was rewarded with scattered giggles from the audience. The tension broke. He hammed it up. He tossed the marble up in the air, letting it almost brush the high cathedral ceiling, then leaned forward and caught it neatly balanced in the hollow of the back of his neck. Somebody did a rim shot on his desk. The room broke up. For his grand finale, Quentin pretended to crush the marble with a heavy iron paperweight, at the last second substituting a mint lifesaver he happened to have in his pocket, which made a nice solid crunch and left behind a forensically convincing spray of white powder. He apologized profusely to Professor March, winking broadly at the audience, then asked him if he could borrow his handkerchief. When he reached for the handkerchief, Professor March discovered the marble in his own jacket pocket. Quentin executed a Johnny Carson golf swing. The first years applauded wildly. He bowed. Not bad, he thought. Half an hour into his first semester, and he was already a folk hero.
"Thank you, Quentin," Professor March said unctuously, clapping with the tips of his fingers. "Thank you. That was very enlightening. You may return to your seat. Alice, what about you? Why don't you show us some magic?"
This remark was addressed to a small, sullen girl with straight blonde hair who had been huddling in the back row. She showed no surprise at being picked. She looked like the kind of person who expected the worst at all times, and why should today be any different? She walked down the wide steps of the lecture hall to the front of the room, eyes straight ahead, cold-bloodedly ascending the gallows, looking hideously uncomfortable in her freshly creased uniform, and mutely accepted her marble from Professor March. Taking her place behind the demonstration table, which came up to her chest, she steadied it on the stone tabletop. Immediately, she made a series of rapid, businesslike gestures over the marble. It looked like she was doing sign language or assembling a cat's cradle with invisible string. Her unfussy manner was the opposite of Quentin's slick, show-offy style. Alice stared at the marble intently, expectantly. Her eyes went a little crossed. Her lips moved, though from where he was sitting, Quentin couldn't hear what she was saying. The marble began to glow red, then white, becoming opaque, an eye clouding over with a milky cataract. A slender, undulating curl of gray smoke rose up from the point where it touched the table. Quentin's smug, triumphant feeling went cold and congealed. She already knew real magic, he thought. My God, I am so far behind. Alice rubbed her hands together.
It takes a minute for my fingers to become impervious.
Cautiously, as if she were retrieving a hot dish from an oven, Alice plucked at the glass marble with her fingertips. It was now molten from the heat, and it pulled like taffy. In four quick, sure motions, she gave the marble four legs, then added a head. When she took her hands away and blew on it, the marble rolled over, shook itself once, and stood up. It had become a tiny, plump, glass animal. It began to walk across the table. This time, no one applauded. The chill in the room was palpable. The hair stood up on Quentin's arms. The only sound was the soft tick-tick-a-tick-a-tick of its pointy glass feet on the stone tabletop.
"Thank you, Alice," Professor March said, regaining the stage. "For those of you who are wondering, Alice just performed three basic spells."
He held up a finger for each one.
"Dempsey's silent thermogenesis, a lesser Cavalieri animation, and some kind of warden shield that appears to be home-brewed, so maybe we should name it after you, Alice."
Alice looked back at March impassively, waiting for a cue that she could go back to her seat. She wasn't even smug, just impatient to be released. Forgotten, the little glass creature reached the end of the table. Alice made a grab for it, but it fell and smashed on the hard stone floor. She crouched down over it, stricken, but Professor March was already moving on, wrapping up his lecture. Quentin watched the little drama with a mixture of compassion and rivalrous envy. "Such a tender soul," he thought. "But she's the one I'll have to beat."
"Tonight, please read the first chapter of Le Goff's Magical History in the Lloyd translation," March said, "and the first two chapters of Amelia Popper's Practical Exercises for Young Magicians, a book that you will soon come to despise with every fiber of your innocent young beings. I invite you to attempt the first four exercises. Each of you will be performing one of them for the class tomorrow. And if you find Lady Popper's rather quaint 18th-century English difficult, keep in mind that next month we will be starting Middle English, Latin, and Old High Dutch, at which time you will look back on Lady Popper's 18th-century English with fond nostalgia."
Students began stirring and gathering up their books. Quentin looked down at the notebook in front of him, which was empty except for one anxious, zigzaggy line.
"Final thought before you go," March raised his voice over the shuffling clatter. "I urge you again to think of this as a purely practical course with a minimum of theory. If you find yourself becoming curious about the nature and origins of the magical powers you are slowly and very, very painfully cultivating, remember this famous anecdote about the English philosopher Bertrand Russell. Russell once gave a public lecture on the structure of the universe. Afterward, he was approached by a woman who told him that he was a very clever young man, but much mistaken in his thinking, because everyone knew that the world was flat and sat on the back of a turtle. When Russell asked her what the turtle was standing on, she replied, 'You're very clever, young man, very clever, but it's turtles all the way down.' The woman was wrong about the world, of course, but she would have been quite right if she'd been talking about magic. Great mages have wasted their lives trying to get at the root of magic. It is a futile pursuit, not much fun, and occasionally quite hazardous, because the farther down you go, the bigger and scalier the turtles get, with sharper and sharper beaks, until eventually they start looking less like turtles and more like dragons. Everyone take a marble, please, as you go."
The very next afternoon, March taught them a simple chant to say over their marbles in a crooked, gypsy-sounding language that Quentin didn't recognize. Later, Alice told him it was Estonian. Accompanied by a tricky gesture that involved moving the middle and pinky fingers on both hands independently, which is a lot harder than it sounds. Those who completed it successfully could leave early. The rest had to stay until they got it right. How would they know when they got it right? They would know. Quentin stayed until his voice was hoarse and his fingers were on fire, until the light in the windows had softened and changed color and then sunk away completely, until his empty stomach ached and dinner had been served and cleared away in the distant dining room. He stayed until his face was warm with shame, and all but four other people had stood up. Some of them pumped their fists in the air and said, "Yes!" and left the classroom. Alice had been the first after about 20 minutes, though she left silently. Finally, Quentin said the chant and made the motions. He didn't even know what he did differently this time, and was rewarded by the sight of his marble wobbling, very slightly, but unmistakably, of its own volition. He didn't say anything, just put his head down on his desk, hiding his face in the crook of his elbow, and let the blood in his head throb in the darkness. The wooden desk was cool on his cheek. It hadn't been a fluke or a hoax or a joke. He had done it. Magic was real, and he could do it. And now that he could, my God, there was so much of it to do. That glass marble would be Quentin's constant companion for the rest of the semester. It was the cold, pitiless glass heart of Professor March's approach to magical pedagogy. Every lecture, every exercise, every demonstration was concerned with how to manipulate and transform it using magic. For the next 4 months, Quentin was required to carry his marble everywhere. He fingered his marble under the table at dinner. It nestled in the inside pockets of his break-bills jacket. When he showered, he tucked it in the soap dish. He took it to bed with him, and on those rare occasions when he slept, he dreamed about it. Quentin learned to cool his marble until it frosted over. He caused it to roll around a table by invisible means. He learned to float his marble in midair. He made it glow from within. Because it was already transparent, it was easy to render invisible, upon which he promptly lost it, and Professor March had to rematerialize it for him. Quentin made his marble float in water, pass through a wooden barrier, fly through an obstacle course, and attract iron filings like a magnet. This was nuts and bolts work, ground-level fundamentals. The dramatic spellcasting display Quentin had performed during his exam, however showy and satisfying, he was told, was a well-understood anomaly, a flare-up of accumulated power that often manifested during a sorcerer's first casting. It would be years before he could do anything comparable again. In the meantime, Quentin also studied the history of magic, about which even magicians knew less than he would have thought. It turned out that magic users had always lived within mainstream society, but apart from it, and largely unknown to it. The towering figures of magical history weren't famous at all in the mundane world, and the obvious guesses were way off base. Leonardo, Roger Bacon, Nostradamus, John Dee, Newton— sure, all of them were mages of various stripes, but of relatively modest ability. The fact that they were famous in mainstream circles was just a strike against them. By the standards of magical society, they'd fallen at the first hurdle. They hadn't had the basic good sense to keep their shit to themselves. Quentin's other homework, Popper's Practical Exercises for Young Magicians, turned out to be a thin, large-format volume containing a series of hideously complex finger and voice exercises arranged in order of increasing difficulty and painfulness. Much of spellcasting, Quentin gathered, consisted of very precise hand gestures accompanied by incantations to be spoken or chanted or whispered or yelled or sung. Any slight error in the movement or in the incantation would weaken or negate or pervert the spell. This wasn't fillery. In each of the fillery novels, one or two of the Chatwin children were always taken under the wing of a kindly Fillorian mentor who taught them a skill or a craft. In The World in the Walls, Martin becomes a master horseman, and Helen trains as a kind of forest scout. In The Flying Forest, Rupert becomes a dead-eye archer. In A Secret Sea, Fiona trains with a master fencer, and so on. The process of learning is a non-stop orgy of wonderment. Learning magic was nothing like that. It turned out to be about as tedious as it was possible for the study of powerful and mysterious supernatural forces to be. The same way a verb has to agree with its subject, it turned out, even the simplest spell had to be modified and tweaked and inflected to agree with the time of day, the phase of the moon, the intention and purpose and precise circumstances of its casting, and 100 other factors, all of which were tabulated in volumes of tables and charts and diagrams printed in microscopic jewel type on huge yellowing elephant folio pages. And half of each page was taken up with footnotes listing the exceptions and irregularities and special cases, all of which had to be committed to memory, too. Magic was a lot wonkier than Quentin thought it would be. But there was something else to it, too. Something beyond all the practicing and memorizing, beyond the dotted I's and crossed T's, something that never came up in March's lectures. Quentin only sensed it without really being able to talk about it, but there was something else you needed if a spell was going to get any purchase on the world around you. Whenever he tried to think about it, he got lost in abstractions. It was something like force of will, a certain intensity of concentration, a clear vision, maybe a dash of artistic brio. If a spell was going to work, then on some gut level, you had to mean it. He couldn't explain it, but Quentin could tell when it was working. He could sense his words and gestures getting traction on the mysterious, magical substrate of the universe. He could feel it physically. His fingertips got warm, and they seemed to leave trails in the air. There was a slight resistance, as if the air were getting viscous around him and pushing back against his hands, and even against his lips and tongue. His mind buzzed with a caffeine-cocaine fizz. He was at the heart of a large and powerful system. He was its heart. When it was working, he knew it. And he liked it. Now that his friends had come back from vacation, Elliot sat with them at meals instead. They were a highly visible clique, always earnestly conferring with each other and having fits of obstreperous public laughter, conspicuously fond of themselves and uninterested in the greater Brakebills populace. There was something different about them, though it was hard to say what. They weren't better looking or smarter than anybody else. They just seemed to know who they were, and they weren't constantly looking around at everybody else as if they could tell them. It rankled the way Elliot dropped Quentin the minute he ceased to be convenient. But then there were 19 other first years to think of, though they weren't a wildly social bunch. They were quiet and intense, always eyeing each other assessingly, as if they were trying to figure out who, if it came right down to it, would take out who in an intellectual death match. They didn't congregate over much. They were always civil, but rarely warm. They were used to competing and used to winning. In other words, they were like Quentin, and Quentin wasn't used to being around people like himself. The one student he and every other first year at Brakebills was immediately obsessed with was little Alice, of the tiny glass creature. But it quickly became apparent that in spite of being way ahead of the rest of her year academically, she was cripplingly shy. to the point where there wasn't much point in trying to talk to her. When approached at meals, she answered questions in whispered monosyllables, her gaze dropping to the tablecloth in front of her as if weighed down by some infinite inner shame. She was almost pathologically unable to make eye contact, and she had a way of hiding her face behind her hair that made it clear how agonizing it was for her to be the object of human attention. Quentin wondered who or what could possibly have convinced somebody with such obvious gifts that she should be frightened of other people. He wanted to keep up a proper head of competitive steam, but instead he felt almost protective of her. The one and only time he saw Alice look genuinely happy was when he watched her, alone and momentarily unself-conscious, successfully skip a pebble across the pool in a fountain and between the legs of a stone nymph. Life at Brakebills had a hushed, formal, almost theatrical tone to it, and at mealtimes formality was elevated to the level of a fetish. Dinners were served promptly at 6:30. Latecomers were denied the privilege of a chair and ate standing. Faculty and students sat together at one interminable table that was swathed in a tablecloth of mystical whiteness and laid with heavy-handled silverware that didn't match. Illumination was provided by battalions of hideous candelabras. The food, contrary to private school tradition, was excellent in an old-fashioned, Frenchified way. Menus tended toward mid-century warhorses like bœuf en daube and lobster thermidor. First years had the privilege of serving all the other students as waiters under the stern direction of chambers, and then eating by themselves when everybody else was done. Third and fourth years were allowed one glass of wine with dinner. Fifth years, or fins, as they were called for no obvious reason, got two. Oddly enough, there were only 10 fourth years, half the usual number, and nobody would explain why. Asking about it just ended the conversation. All this Quentin picked up with the speed of a sailor cast away on a savage foreign continent who has no choice but to learn the local language as rapidly as possible or be devoured by those who speak it. His first 2 months at Brakebills spun by, and soon red and gold leaves were scattering across the sea as if they were being pushed by invisible brooms, which possibly they were, and the flanks of the slow-moving topiary beasts in the maze showed streaks of color. Quentin devoted a half hour every day after class to exploring the campus on foot. One blustery afternoon he stumbled onto a pocket vineyard, a postage stamp of earth ruled into straight lines and planted with rows of grapevines strung up on rusty wires and trained into weird viticultural candelabra shapes. By now the grapes had already been harvested, and those that hadn't had shriveled on the vine into tiny, fragrant raisins. Beyond it, a quarter mile off into the woods at the end of a narrow path, Quentin discovered a small field neatly divided into a patchwork of squares. Some of the squares were grass, some were stone, some were sand, some were water, and two were made of blackened, silvery metal, elaborately inscribed. There was no fence or wall to mark the edge of the grounds, or if there was, he never found it. There was just the river along one side and woods all around the rest. Even so, the faculty seemed to spend an inordinate amount of time maintaining the spells that kept the school invisible and impregnable to outsiders. They were constantly strolling the perimeter, studying things Quentin couldn't see, and pulling one another out of classes to consult about it. Snow. One afternoon in late October, Professor March asked Quentin to stay behind after practical applications. PA, as everybody called it, was the part of the day when the students worked on actual spellcasting. They were allowed to attempt only the most basic magic at this stage, under smotheringly close supervision, but still. It was a small practical reward for all those oceans of theory they were navigating. That particular class had not been a successful one for Quentin. PA was held in a room that resembled a college chemistry lab. Indestructible gray stone tables, counters mottled with ancient, unspeakable stains, deep, capacious sinks. The air was thickly charged with permanent charms and wards installed by generations of Brakebill's professors to prevent students from injuring themselves or each other. It carried a whiff of ozone. Quentin watched his lab partner, Surendra, dust his hands with a white powder, equal parts flour and beechwood ash, draw certain invisible sigils in the air with a freshly trimmed willow wand, and then bring the wand softly down on his marble, nickname Rakshasa. Slicing it neatly in half with one stroke, first try. But when Quentin brought the willow wand down on his marble, nickname Martin, it burst with a quiet pop, like a dying light bulb throwing off a spray of glass chunks and powder. Quentin dropped the wand and spun away to shield his eyes. Everybody else in the room craned their heads to look. The atmosphere in the PA room wasn't particularly collegial. So Quentin was already in a foul mood when Professor March asked him to stay behind after class. March chatted with stragglers in the hall while Quentin sat on one of the indestructible tables, swinging his legs and thinking black thoughts. He was somewhat reassured that Alice had been asked to stay behind, too. She sat by the window staring dreamily out at the sluggish Hudson. Her marble floated in slow circles around her head, a lazy miniature satellite sometimes clicking against the glass when she leaned too close. Why did magic come to her so effortlessly, he wondered. Or was it as effortless as it looked? He couldn't believe it was as hard for her as it was for him. Penny was there, too, looking pale and intense and moon-faced as always. He wore the Brakebill's uniform, but they'd let him keep his mohawk. Professor March came back in, followed by Professor Vandeveya. She didn't mince words.
We asked you three to stay behind because we are considering advancing you to second year for the spring term, she said. You would have to do some extra work on your own in order to pass your first year exams in December and then catch up to the second years, but I think you are up to it. Am I right?
She looked around encouragingly. She wasn't really asking them so much as telling them. Quentin and Penny and Alice glanced at one another uneasily and looked away again. From long experience, Quentin had learned not to be surprised when his intellectual abilities were rated over other people's, and this mark of favor certainly wiped out the nightmare of his pulverized marble with interest. But everybody was acting very solemn and serious about it. It sounded like a lot of work for the privilege of skipping a year at Brakebill's, which he wasn't even sure he wanted to do anyway.
Why? Penny spoke up. Why move us up? Are you going to move other students down to make room for us?
He had a point. It was an immutable fact of life at Brakebill's that there were always 20 students per class, no more and no fewer.
Different students learn at different speeds, Penny, was all she said. We want to keep everybody where they are most comfortable.
There were no further questions. After a suitable interval, Professor Vandeveya accepted their silence as consent.
All right, then, she said. Good luck to all of you.
Those words plunged Quentin into a new and darker phase of his life at Brakebill's, just when he'd gotten comfortable with the old one. Until then, he'd worked hard, but he got in his share of malingering like everybody else. He wandered around campus and killed time with the other first years in the first year's lounge, which was a shabby but cozy room with a fireplace and an assortment of critically injured couches and armchairs and embarrassingly lame
educational board games, basically magical versions of Trivial Pursuit, all warped and stained and missing crucial pieces and cards and spinners. They even had a contraband video game console set up in a closet, a 3-year-old box hooked up to an even older TV. It fuzzed out and rebooted whenever anybody fired up a spell within 200 yards of it, which was pretty much constantly. That was before. Now there was no time when Quentin wasn't studying. As often as Elliot had warned him about what he was in for, and as hard as he'd worked up till now, he still somehow imagined that learning magic would turn out to be a delightful journey through a secret garden where he would gaily pluck the heavy fruit of knowledge from conveniently low-hanging branches. Instead, every afternoon after PA, Quentin went straight to the library to rush through his regular homework so he could betake himself after dinner to the library where his appointed tutor waited for him. His tutor was Professor Sunderland, the pretty young woman who had asked him to draw maps during his examination. She looked nothing like a magician was supposed to. She was blonde and dimply and distractingly curvy. Professor Sunderland taught mostly upper-level courses, fourth and fifth years, and didn't have much patience for amateurs. She drilled him relentlessly on gestures and incantations and charts and tables, and when he was perfect, that was a start, but she'd like to see Popper Etudes number 7 and number 13 again, please, slowly, forward and then backward, just to make sure. Her hands did things Quentin couldn't imagine his hands ever doing. It would have been intolerable if Quentin didn't have a ferocious crush on Professor Sunderland. He almost felt like he was betraying Julia. But what did he owe her? It's not like she even would have cared, and Professor Sunderland was here. He wanted somebody who was part of his new world. Julia had her chance. Quentin spent a lot more of his time with Alice and Penny now. Breakbills had an 11 o'clock lights-out policy for first years, but with their extra workload, the three of them had to find a way around it. Fortunately, there was a small study off one of the student wings that, according to Breakbill's lore, was exempt from whatever monitoring spells the faculty used to enforce curfew. Probably they left it like that deliberately as a loophole for situations like this. It was a leftover space, musty, windowless, and trapezoidal, but it had a couch and a table and chairs, and the faculty never checked it after hours, so that was where Quentin, Alice, and Penny went when the rest of the first years went to bed. They made an odd little tribe, Alice sitting hunched over the table, Quentin sprawled on the couch, Penny pacing in circles or sitting cross-legged on the floor. The odious Popper books were hexed in such a way that you could practice in front of them and they would tell you if you'd screwed up or not by turning green, good, or red, bad, although annoyingly they wouldn't tell you how you'd screwed up. But Alice always knew how you screwed up. Of the three of them, she was the prodigy, with preternaturally flexible hands and wrists and a freakish memory. When it came to languages, she was omnivorous and insatiable. While her classmates were still wallowing in the shallows of Middle English, she was already plunging into Arabic and Aramaic and Old High Dutch and Old Church Slavonic. She was still painfully shy, but the late nights she spent with Quentin and Penny in the after-hours room wore away some of her reserve, to the point where she would, sometimes, exchange notes and pointers with the other two. Once in a while, she even revealed a sense of humor, though more often than not she made her jokes in Old Church Slavonic. They probably would have been lost on Penny anyway. He had no sense of humor at all. He practiced by himself, murmuring and watching his pale hands sign and flutter in a massive, baroque, gilt-framed mirror leaned up against the wall. The mirror had an old, fading, forgotten enchantment on it, so Penny's reflection was sometimes replaced with an image of a treeless, green hillside, a smooth, grassy curve under an overcast sky.
It was like a TV with a poorly installed cable box, picking up a stray image from far away, some other world. Rather than take a break, Penny would just wait silently and impassively for the image to change back. Secretly, the mirror made Quentin nervous, as if something horrible were about to come strolling over the top of that hill, or was buried restlessly underneath it.
"I wonder where it is," Alice said, "in real life."
"I don't know," Quentin said. "Maybe it's in Fillory."
"You could climb through. That's always how it works in the books."
"How great would that be? Think about it. We could go through and study for a month and come back and ace this thing."
"Please don't tell me you're going to go to Fillory so you can get more homework done," Alice said, "because that would be the saddest thing I've ever heard."
"A little quiet, people," Penny said.
For a punk, Penny could be an unbelievable drag. Winter descended, a deep, bitter cold Hudson Valley winter. The fountains froze over and the maze was traced in white snow, except where the topiary animals shivered and humped up and shook it off. Quentin and Alice and Penny found themselves drawing apart from their classmates, who regarded them with envy and resentment that Quentin didn't have the time or energy to deal with. For the time being, they were their own exclusive club within the already closed club of breakbills. Quentin was rediscovering his love of work. It wasn't really a thirst for knowledge that kept him going, or any desire to live up to Professor Van de Veya's belief that he belonged in second year. It was mostly just the familiar, perverse satisfaction of repetitive, back-breaking labor, the same masochistic pleasure that had enabled him to master the Mills Mess pattern and the Pharaoh Shuffle and the Charlier Cut and to lay waste to Calculus II when he was still in eighth grade. A few of the older students took pity on the three marathon crammers. They adopted them as mascots the way a class of kindergartners would adopt a family of gerbils. They egged them on and brought them snacks and sodas after hours. Even Elliot condescended to visit, bringing with him a set of illegal charms and talismans for staying awake and reading faster, though it was hard to tell whether they worked or not. They were procured, he said, from a seedy itinerant salesman who turned up at breakbills once or twice a year in an old wood-paneled station wagon crammed with junk. December slid by on silent runners, in a sleepless dream of constant toil. The work had lost all connection to whatever goal it was supposed to be accomplishing. Even Quentin's sessions with Professor Sunderland lost their spark. He caught himself staring bleakly at the radiant upper slopes of her achingly full and gropable breasts, when he knew he should be devoting himself to far more pressing technical issues, like correct thumb position. His crush went from exciting to depressing, as if he'd gone from the first blush of infatuation to the terminal nostalgia of a former lover, without even the temporary relief of an actual relationship in between. Now he floated through Professor March's lectures from the back row, feeling lofty contempt for his classmates, who were only on Popper Etude No. 27, when he had already scaled the glorious heights of No. 51 and watched it grow tiny beneath his still-climbing feet. He began to hate the grungy, misshapen room where he and Penny and Alice did their late-night cramming. He hated the bitter, burned smell of the coffee they drank, to the point where he almost felt tempted to try the low-grade speed Penny took as an alternative. He recognized the irritable, unpleasant, unhappy person he was becoming. He looked strangely like the Quentin he thought he'd left behind in Brooklyn. Quentin didn't do all his studying in the trapezoidal spare room. On weekends, he could work wherever he wanted, at least during the daytime. Mostly he stayed in his own room, but sometimes he climbed the long spiral staircase up to the Breakbills Observatory, a respectable if antiquated facility at the top of one of the towers. It contained a massive late 19th century telescope, the size of a telephone pole, poking up at an angle through a tarnished copper dome. Somebody on the staff must have been deeply in love with this obsolete instrument, because it floated on an exquisitely complicated array of brass gears and joints that was kept freshly oiled and in a state of high polish. Quentin liked to read in the observatory because it was high up and well heated and relatively unfrequented. Not only was it hard to get to, the telescope was useless during the day. This was usually enough to secure him an afternoon of lofty, wintry solitude. But on one Saturday in late November, he discovered that he wasn't the only one who'd figured this out. When Quentin reached the top of the spiral staircase, the trap door was already open. He poked his head up into the circular, amber-lit room. It was like he'd poked his head into another world, an alien planet that looked eerily like his own, but rearranged. The interloper was Elliot. He was kneeling like a supplicant in front of an old orange armchair with ripped upholstery that stood in the middle of the room, in the center of the circular track that the telescope ran on. Quentin always wondered who had gotten the chair up there in the first place, and why they'd bothered. Magic was obviously involved, since it wouldn't have fit through the trap door, or even any of the tiny windows. Elliot wasn't alone. There was somebody sitting in the chair. The angle was bad, but he thought it was one of the second years, an unexceptional, smooth-cheeked kid with straight, rust-colored hair. Quentin barely knew him. His name might have been Eric. "No," Eric said, and then again sharply, "no, absolutely not." He was smiling. Elliot started to stand up, but the boy held him down playfully by his shoulders. He wasn't especially large. The authority he exercised over Elliot wasn't physical. "You know the rules," he said, like he was speaking to a child.
"Please, just this once."
Quentin had never heard Elliot speak in that pleading, wheedling, infantile tone before.
"Please."
It was not a tone he had ever expected to hear Elliot speak in.
"Absolutely not."
Eric touched the tip of Elliot's long, pale nose with his finger.
"Not until you finish all your chores, every single one, and take off that stupid shirt. It's pathetic."
Quentin got that it was a game they'd played before. He was watching a very private ritual. "All right," Elliot said petulantly. "And there is nothing wrong with this shirt," he muttered. Eric cut him off with a look. Then he spat once, a white fleck on Elliot's pristine shirt front. Quentin saw the fear behind Eric's eyes as he wondered if he'd gone too far. From this angle, the armchair might have blocked Quentin's view, but it didn't quite, as Elliot fumbled jinglingly with Eric's belt buckle, then his fly, then jerked down his pants, exposing his thin, pale thighs.
"Careful," Eric warned.
There wasn't much affection in his play-acting, if that's what it was.
"Little bitch, you know the rules."
Quentin couldn't have said why he waited an extra minute before he ducked back down the ladder, back into his staid, predictable home universe. But he couldn't stop watching. He was looking directly at the exposed wiring of Elliot's emotional machinery. How could he not have known about this? He wondered if it was an annual thing. Maybe Elliot went through a boy or two a year, anointing them and then discarding them when they no longer did the trick. Did he really have to hide like this, even at break bills? On some level, Quentin was hurt. If this was what Elliot wanted, why hadn't he come after Quentin? Though as much as he longed for Elliot's attention, he didn't know if he could have gone through with it.
It was better this way.
Elliot wouldn't have forgiven him for refusing. The desperate hunger with which Elliot regarded the object on which he would perform his chores was unlike anything Quentin had ever seen. He was right in Elliot's line of sight, but he never once glanced over at him.
Quentin decided he would do his reading elsewhere. He finished Lady Amelia Popper's Practical Exercises for Young Magicians, Volume 1, at midnight, the night before the exam, a Sunday. He carefully closed the book and sat for a minute staring at the cover. His hands shook. His head felt spinny and weightless. His body was unnaturally heavy. He couldn't stay where he was, but he was too wired to go to bed either. He heaved himself up from the broken-backed couch and announced that he was going for a walk. To his surprise, Alice offered to come with him. Penny just stared at the green, overcast landscape in the mirror, waiting for his pale, stoic face to reappear so he could keep practicing. He didn't look up as they left. Quentin's idea had been to walk out through the maze and across the snowbound sea to its outer edge, where he had first arrived, and look back at the hushed hulk of the house and think about why this was turning out to be so much less fun than it should have been, and try to calm down enough to go to sleep. He supposed he could do that equally well with Alice as he could alone. He headed for the tall French doors that opened onto the back terrace.
"Not that way," Alice said.
After hours, the French doors were set to trigger a magical alert in the bedroom of whatever faculty member was on call, infallible, Alice explained, to discourage students from breaking curfew. She led him around to a side door he'd never seen before, unalarmed and concealed behind a tapestry that opened out into a snow-covered hedge. They squeezed themselves through it and into the freezing darkness. Quentin was easily 8 inches taller than Alice, most of it in his legs, but she kept pace with him doggedly. They navigated the maze together in the moonlight and set out across the frozen sea. The snow was half a foot deep, and they kicked little spills of it ahead of them as they walked.
"I come out here every night," Alice said, breaking the silence.
In his sleep-deprived state, Quentin had almost forgotten she was there.
"Every night?" he said stupidly. "You do? Why?"
"Just, you know," she sighed. Her breath puffed out white in the moonlight. "To clear my head. It gets noisy in the girls' tower. You can't think. It's quiet out here." It was strange how normal it felt to be alone with the usually antisocial Alice.
"It's cold out here. You think they know you break curfew?"
"Of course. Fog does, anyway."
"So if he knows, why bother taking the side door?"
The sea was like a smooth, clean sheet laid out around them, tucked in at the corners. Except for a few deer and wild turkeys, nobody else had been across it since the last snowfall.
"I don't think he really cares that much if we sneak out, but he appreciates it if you make an effort."
They reached the edge of the great lawn and turned and looked back toward the house. One light was on, a teacher's bedroom on a lower floor. An owl called. A hazy moon bleached the clouds white above the blocky outline of the roof. The scene was like an unshaken snow globe. Quentin flashed on a memory from the Fillory books, the part in The World in the Walls, when Martin and Fiona go wandering through the frozen woods looking for the trees the Watcherwoman has enchanted, each of which has a round ticking clock embedded in its trunk. As villains went, the Watcherwoman was an odd specimen, since she rarely did anything particularly evil, or at any rate not where anybody could see her do it. She was usually glimpsed from a distance, rushing around with a book in one hand and an elaborate timepiece in the other. Sometimes she drove a terrifyingly elaborate ormolu clock carriage that ticked loudly as it raced along. She always wore a veil that covered her face. Wherever she passed, she planted her signature clock trees. Quentin caught himself listening for ticking, but there was no sound except for an occasional frozen crack from deep in the forest, its origin unguessable.
"This is where I came through the first time," he said, "in the summer. I didn't even know what break bills was. I thought I was in Fillory."
Alice laughed. A surprising, hilarious shout. Quentin hadn't actually meant it to be quite that funny.
"Sorry," she said. "God, I used to love those books when I was little."
"So where did you come through?"
"Over there."
She pointed at another identical stretch of trees.
"But I didn't come through like you. I mean, through a portal."
They must have had some special extra-magical form of conveyance for infallible Alice, he thought. It was hard not to envy her. A phantom toll booth, or a chariot of fire, probably, drawn by thestrals.
"When I came, I walked here. I wasn't invited."
She was talking in questions with exaggerated casualness, but her voice was suddenly wobbly.
"I had a brother who went here. I always wanted to come too, but they never invited me. After a while I was getting too old, so I ran away. I'd been waiting and waiting for an invitation, and it never came. I knew I'd already missed the first year. I'm a year older than you, you know."
He hadn't known. She looked younger.
"So I took a bus from Urbana to Poughkeepsie, then taxis from there as far as I could. Did you ever notice there's no driveway here? No roads, either. The nearest one is the state highway."
This was the longest speech Quentin had ever heard Alice make.
"I had them let me off on the shoulder in the middle of nowhere. I had to walk the last 5 miles. I got lost. Slept in the woods."
"You slept in the woods? Like on the ground?"
"I know. I should have brought a tent. Or something. I don't know what I was thinking. I was just hysterical."
"What about your brother? He couldn't let you in?"
"He died."
She offered this neutrally, purely informationally, but it brought Quentin up short. He had never imagined that Alice could have a sibling, let alone a dead one, or that she led anything other than a charmed life.
"Alice," he said, "this doesn't make any sense. You do realize you're the smartest person in our class."
She shrugged off the compliment with one shoulder, staring fiercely up at the house.
"So you just walked in? What did they do?" "They couldn't believe it. Nobody's supposed to be able to find the house by themselves. They thought it was just an accident, but it's so obvious. There's old magic here, tons of it. This whole place is wild with it. If you look at it through the right spells, it lights up like a forest fire." "They must have thought I was a homeless person. I had twigs in my hair. I'd been crying all night. Professor Vandeveya felt sorry for me. She gave me coffee and let me take the entrance exam all by myself. Fogg didn't want to let me, but she made him."
"And you passed." She shrugged again.
"I still don't get it," Quentin said. "Why didn't you get invited like the rest of us?"
She didn't answer, just stared up angrily at the hazy moon. There were tears on her cheeks. He realized that he had just casually put into words what was probably the overwhelming question of Alice's entire existence at Breakbills. It occurred to him, long after it should have, that he wasn't the only person here who had problems and felt like an outsider. Alice wasn't just the competition, someone whose only purpose in life was to succeed and by doing so subtract from his happiness. She was a person with her own hopes and feelings and history and nightmares. In her own way, she was as lost as he was. They were standing in the shadow of an enormous fir tree, a shaggy blue-gray monster groaning with snow. It made Quentin think of Christmas, and he suddenly realized that they'd missed it. He'd forgotten they were on break Bill's time. Real Christmas, in the rest of the world, had been 2 months ago, and he hadn't even noticed. His parents had said something about it on the phone, but the dime hadn't dropped. Funny how things like that stopped mattering. He wondered what James and Julia had done for vacation. They'd talked about all of them going up to Lake Placid together. Her parents had a cabin there. And what did matter?